We are joined here live in the studios by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was hearing something there in the background. What?
Probably me clearing my throat.
Oh, okay.
It was the federal agents outside.
Okay. That was Jav reaching for something that I needed to worry about. All right, so very exciting weekend. We are just days away now from a major election that was primarily supposed to be a local election, but apparently has plenty of outside influence and is
lots
have
of
some,
national attention.
It's really going to be a referendum on who's going to run Seattle.
I think so.
And it's going to be a real interesting to see the results. Mm-hmm. You know, big money often is very effective in influencing elections, but there's been a real pushback on the influence of Amazon and some of the other big corporations that have contributed to PACs, and we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, well, and keep in mind too, there are a lot of new residents to Seattle just in the last 3 or 4 years who are not familiar with our background, maybe not familiar with our progressive culture as so much, so they could play a role in swinging the city council
absolutely.
To a more conservative direction.
And that demographic change, we've been sort of waiting to see that influence local elections for several years now, and I think this might be the election where it does. The other thing to watch for on the ballot drops that come Tuesday night and subsequent nights is that in the primary, the progressive candidates all improved by 3 to 5 percentage points with the subsequent ballot drop. So the results and close elections on election night may not be the final election. So keep an eye on it, and we'll bring you the report next week.
The ballot drop being the counts they do every night for 2 weeks or whatever it lasts.
And there's only one on election night. That comes about 8:15, and then subsequent days, it's about, I think, 4:30 in the afternoon for people who are hopeless geeks like us.
Or for those races where it's close enough that the ballot drop makes a difference.
Absolutely. And I think we'll have at least a couple of those.
Yeah, I know in past years, Shama Sawant certainly benefited quite a bit from late ballot drops in her prior races. So.
Yes, and in the primary, she improved by, I think about 5 percentage points between election night and the final count. And same, the others, sort of grassroots candidates, also benefited from 3 to 5 percentage points.
Yeah, those...
because what happens is the candidates with a lot of volunteer base, which tend to be the grassroots candidates, are more effective in door knocking and registering people who are voting at the last moment.
Mm-hmm.
So look for that.
And reminding people at the last moment, make sure you get your ballot filled out and mailed.
Absolutely.
There's there was some other election news this week.
Oh, yeah.
Egan O'Ryan's campaign decided to file amended public disclosure forms with the Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission. Local reporter Erica Barnett, who writes a blog entitled The C is for Crank, reported that O'Ryan's campaign office is in a building owned by Ian Eisenberg, who owns the Uncle Ike's pot shop. Eisenberg was letting O'Ryan use that space rent-free, which would have been an in-kind contribution to O'Ryan's campaign that exceeds the $250 campaign limit for candidates taking democracy vouchers, as O'Ryan has been doing. O'Ryan had not reported any in-kind contributions from Eisenberg in his SEC filings. But this week, his campaign filed amended reports showing that the value of his office space is $500 per month, a steal, I think, for a standalone office building at 21st and Union in the Central District. So that raises the question of whether O'Ryan and Eisenberg are undervaluing the space. And that in itself could be a campaign violation if O'Ryan is saying, well, I decided to pay $1,000 in rent for 2 months on a space that's really valued at several thousand dollars per month, then that's a problem.
It would be interesting to see, and I'm sure enterprising reporters like Barnett are trying to figure out whether Eisenberg had rented that space previously,
and
if so, to whom,
and
at what rate.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, if he's cutting Ryan a big deal, if that, a bargain, if that's more than $250 worth of value for 2 months, that is a campaign violation.
Yeah, and that could mean some fines for Egan O'Ryan and his campaign.
But that's primarily that's all it means is some minor fines. I mean, his stranger cover advertisement cost them all of $1,000.
That was a one-time ad.
Right.
Yeah. It's a different thing when you're providing office space for a campaign that's valued at several thousand dollars, yeah, perhaps, and you're not and the candidate's not reporting that.
Seems to me the value more is in the potential loss of votes or the shifting of votes in the time mm-hmm. period than it is really the monetary fine.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a narrative that Orion has been pretty sloppy with things like the stranger cover and the office space and some of the other campaign contributions that he's getting, and that may shift votes because there's been a real question. A lot of Orion's support has been anti-Sawant sentiment, and there's been real questions raised in the last several weeks about whether you want Orion on city council, whether in fact the solution is worse than the problem for people who don't like Sawant. And I think some of those votes have been shifting in recent weeks, so it's going to be a close election.
Yeah, I think so too. Now, also in election news, David Gutman at the Seattle Times reported this week that while Facebook and Google pledged to stop selling political advertisements for elections in Washington state, both have broken that pledge. Facebook has sold at least $39,000 worth of ads, and Google has sold at least $25,000 worth.
And anybody who's been online has seen them. This is pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm. Now, most of the ads are funded by PACs, like the Civic Alliance for a Sound Economy, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC, which, and the Seattle Firefighters Union PAC, which, whose ads listing their preferred candidates for city council, that's the same candidates that the chamber supports, were seen by as many as 200,000 people. Google and Facebook's pledges were made after Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued the companies for violating state campaign finance laws by not disclosing specific information about who is paying for the ads, including names and addresses, what geographic regions are targeted by the ads, and the number of views for each ad. And that's all information that other media outlets routinely provide to the state of Washington, including newspapers, radio stations, and TV stations about ads that run on air. Now, Google and Facebook settled that lawsuit with Washington State and paid the state about $450,000. And after they settled that lawsuit, they then announced that they were pledging not to take any more campaign advertising for Washington State elections. But of course, those two tech giants are still breaking the law, and the state has filed a new lawsuit against Facebook. And Google remains under investigation. Facebook, for their part, is saying that they're not, quote, a commercial advertiser, end quote, in spite of the fact.
Yeah, right.
And that's in spite of the fact that you regularly see commercial advertisements on their platform.
And that Facebook and Google have an outsized percentage of all online revenue for advertising.
Oh, yeah. And Google, on the other hand, calls the political ads that they've run, quote, a third party's illicit requisition of Google's platform, end quote. And I'm sure that the revenue that Google is receiving for that, quote unquote, illicit activity is certainly an incentive for the company to continue to overlook this problem.
They seem to like illicit revenue.
They do.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. So, and I don't know how if you're processing payments and you're accepting advertisements ostensibly somebody's overseeing that, right? They're making the decision whether to accept advertising, and if not, then that's a problem.
Well, a lot of their particularly Facebook, but also Google, a lot of it's automated online.
Yeah, I know. That's what really gets at the heart here is when you automate that kind of stuff, there's no AI that's sophisticated enough to be able to screen out that kind of thing. So when you make a pledge that you're not going to take certain types of advertisement, you need a human being looking at all your ads.
And this is not a new issue. I mean, Facebook and Google have gotten a lot of trouble in 2016 for the Russian influence in their elections, mm-hmm. which targeted that automated system and exploited it. Because neither Facebook nor Google had any kind of means of
no controls
to try and figure out. This is illegal because it's coming from outside the country, and that's a federal campaign violation. But that problem is still in evidence and is probably going to be a factor in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like they could easily have real human eyeballs checking this stuff out. I mean, Facebook was just criticized recently for the thousands of employees that it has that have to go through all the violent and disgusting video content that people post, and that these, they're, I mean, I can't remember. It's in the tens of thousands of people that they employ for this,
yeah,
paying them all $15 an hour.
And a lot of it's in the Philippines, and a lot of them are really traumatized by what they have to watch.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think it came out that Mark Zuckerberg said they're allocated like, I think, 6 minutes a day for PTSD downtime to deal with the harsh content they have to deal with.
Oh, wow. That's really generous.
Keep in mind, I mean, state and federal laws allow people that kind of a break once an hour, not once a day. So
yes, but this is out of the country. So it will be, you know, the Philippines or whatever country they're in. Whatever laws, if any, govern that.
Yeah, so I don't quite understand how Mark Zuckerberg bragging about that is actually a good thing.
And again, it will be easy to control this with the eyeballs looking at it, but that costs Facebook and Google money, mm-hmm. and they don't really want to spend that if they can avoid it. I mean, they have to do it for things like the violent posting and stuff like that, but. Because it would be a PR disaster if it came out that they were just letting it all go through, which I'm sure at one point they were, and they got criticized for it. But the campaign ads are a problem, too, that they need to deal with. And there's going to be a lot of pressure on them to deal with it in 2020.
So other developments with the local advertising or spending this week?
As of Thursday, there was $2.1 million having been spent in the city council races, the seven districts, by conservative PACs. This, again, from the Seattle Times, and about $1 million by labor PACs. Now, that $2.1 million, they did not include some of the stuff that they lumped in miscellaneous, like Moms for Seattle,
which is
also clearly a conservative PAC.
Yeah.
But regardless, that $2.1 million is roughly 4 to 5 times what most successful city council campaigns have spent in the past. So we're seeing a real sea change in who's spending money and why. And you're starting to see some of the beneficiaries of this. One of the spokespeople for Orion's campaign certainly said this in the Times article, where the campaign's own messages are being drowned out by the PAC's messages. So the campaigns can't even get their own messages out because their erstwhile allies, which are prohibited by law from contributing, coordinating with them, are drowning out their messages and not allowing candidates to frame their own case to the public. It's being done instead by these PACs, which tend to be much more negative toward their opponents and not really clearly emphasizing the issues that particular candidates might want to be running on.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So, like you said, it's a national race for a local office.
It is. And I'm actually kind of surprised. I regularly get because I'm considered media on some of the lists, and I get an email from an organization that does national betting and sends... And I'm surprised that I haven't gotten an email this week about the odds on the different races here in Seattle from the folks in Vegas.
Yeah, I'm sure they have something posted on the big board.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
All right. So next week we're gonna have some interesting results.
Yes, we'll run down all the races.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on, but sticking with City Council. City Council has been, since what, early September, wrestling with the budget issues?
Since early October, working on the city budget.
The departments start in late August, early September, but the council itself comes from about a month ago.
Yeah, the mayor typically releases his or her budget proposal. The mayor proposes and the council disposes, which means once the mayor has proposed his or her budget, in this case her budget, then the city council gets to figure out what it gets to go in with scissors and cut things out and cut and paste and move things around. And they take the final vote and what they say is the end result. So the city council, like you said, is in the middle of doing that. There are 77 specific changes that various council members have proposed so far. A lot of them won't garner majority support on the council, but there are a few that could. And I want to talk about some of those and some of the more interesting proposals that may or may not get a majority, but I think are quite interesting in telling us what the council's priorities are, or various council members' priorities are. Now, first off is reallocating the proceeds from the Mercer Mega Block sale. That was one of the biggest changes in Mayor Durkin's budget proposal from the prior year, was the influx of money from the sale of that huge parcel of city-owned land on Mercer Street in South Lake Union. Some of that money will pay off debts that the city has, including debts on the land itself and on a couple of transportation projects like the South Lake Union trolley and the South Lake Union streetcar and the Mercer beautification project, particularly the west portion of that.
And we talked at length in previous weeks about, you know, the competing bids for that parcel of land and why the city chose that particular bid. Even though it wasn't necessarily the most lucrative or the most amenable in terms of providing affordable housing.
Yeah. Now, the after paying off debts, then the money gets split between two uses. One is transportation. Some of it will go into transportation because that parcel of land was originally purchased with money from the transportation from the city's Department of Transportation. And the other big chunk, about $41.7 million, will go for affordable housing. That's what Durkin has proposed. Durkin proposed that $41.7 million will go into a strategic investment fund to purchase land for affordable housing in the future. Council member Teresa Mosqueda wants to direct $15 million of the Mercer Mega Block proceeds instead to a program for shovel-ready affordable housing projects that apply every year to the city for funding assistance. There's a long list of those affordable housing projects, and most of them are turned away from getting city funds, and she would like to direct more money towards them because they're ready to be built now.
Yeah, and that $41 million, that's a long pipeline. It's a fund for purchasing land, and after that, you still have to develop the land. And you not just build the building, but go through all the permitting process and all the rest of it. That can take many
design
years,
and
we've got
that.
A crisis right now.
Yeah. Mike O'Brien has proposed adding a budget proviso. A proviso is a hold on spending the funds that's conditioned on something. He wants to put a proviso on the entire $41 million, and the condition is that the city, to hold that money until the city submits a spending and implementation plan to the city council to make the process more transparent on what that money would be used for, how the projects would be selected for it. Now, Durkin wants to spend about $6 million of the Mercer Mega Block proceeds on a loan program to help homeowners build accessory dwelling units. That's backyard cottages and mother-in-law apartments. Lorena Gonzalez wants to redirect the bulk of that money to shovel-ready affordable housing projects, while requiring the rest of the money to be put on hold until the city does a racial equity toolkit analysis of the ADU loan program, the accessory dwelling unit loan program, specifically to determine who is going to benefit from it, whether it's going to be middle-class white homeowners, as Gonzalez suspects, or lower-income racially diverse homeowners, as Durkin contends.
And the O'Brien proviso amendment is specifically because Durkin has, in the last couple of years, tried to move around money that the council has allocated for other things to her pet projects,
yeah.
And he's trying to prevent that.
He's trying to make sure there's some there's some kind of process in place that the city has committed to for what that money, how that money will be allocated and spent,
and that the city council has a say in it.
Yeah, now Shama Sawant has proposed that $22.5 million of the housing proceeds be used to fund the first 6 months of debt service on $500 million in 20-year bonds to build affordable housing right now. Her proposal, however, that's a good idea, but her proposal doesn't specify where the remaining money for debt service will come from. And again, the $22.5 million would only pay for half a year. In 2020, that means there's another $22.4 million in interest that the city would have, that the city council would have to squeeze out of the budget somewhere to support that, those $500 million in 20-year bonds. And then they're committed for 20 years each year to find the interest payments in the city budget somewhere. So I don't see other council members supporting that. But it's an interesting idea. of issuing city bonds for affordable housing. It's something that the city council should be digging deeper into. Now, do you have any other comments on the housing piece?
No, let's keep going.
Okay. So I want to look at allocating the Uber and Lyft tax revenue. Mayor Durkin has proposed increasing the city's tax on Uber and Lyft rides from 24 cents to 75 cents. She would spend the funds on the city connector streetcar and affordable housing, about equal amounts to both of those. Council member Lisa Herbold is fine with the housing piece. However, she has proposed removing the streetcar from the list of projects eligible to receive funding from that tax. Instead, she'd spend the money on extending light rail to Ballard and West Seattle. And West Seattle is her district. This, of course, might not go over well with Sally Bagshaw, who is in charge of the budgeting process. She's the council member who compiles all the different budget proposals and tries to come up with a balanced budget. She represents District 7, where the City Connector streetcar is very popular with the Downtown Business Association. But of course, other council members may like Herbold's proposal and may join her.
Yeah, and that connector project for the streetcar has run into all kinds of cost overruns and is of dubious value in terms of the city's transportation.
Yeah, it is network. Not really envisioned as a, well, I mean, those who support it say that it is a viable transportation option for commuters, but it's not. It's really meant to be a transportation showpiece for tourists and to increase property values.
Yeah.
And to link up developers who are currently developing a lot of projects in the Central District, to link up those luxury condos and apartments with jobs in downtown and South Lake Union.
I think also a lot of the purpose of it is to allow tourists from cruise ships to get to the downtown retail core more easily getting up the hill.
And to move them to other nearby neighborhoods where they can do further shopping, like the International District, South Lake Union, and various other, to connect it to the South Lake Union streetcar and Broadway and Capitol Hill.
You know, we could just ditch the connector and extract money from the tourists as they get off the cruise ships, and that might be a lot more efficient all the way around.
Yeah.
Just give us a couple $100 and you can walk on the waterfront. That's fine.
Yeah. Now, I want to also talk a little bit, too, about Durkin's solution for high-barrier individuals. That's the new term for what they call prolific offenders, the very small number of homeless people who routinely are arrested or get in trouble for shoplifting and other petty crimes. City council members have attacked Durkin's pilot programs for treating those high barrier individuals as proposals that are too vague or won't work. Various council members have proposed budget provisos holding funding for those programs until the city submits more information about them, because Durkin's proposals were very vague.
And Durkin's track record of what to do about homeless individuals, particularly downtown, has frequently amounted to, let's shove them around to other neighborhoods. And that's
the navigation team.
Yep.
Now, one of those proposals was a probation program that came under withering criticism from several city council members. Lorena Gonzalez wants to cut that program entirely. And she has also proposed that the city auditor review the Seattle Municipal Court's existing probation program, particularly its impact on people of color versus white people who go through the system. Now, there are almost identical proposals from O'Brien, Gonzalez, and Sawant to allocate the full $4.7 million funding requested by the city's Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, better known as LEAD, which diverts low-level drug and prostitution offenders into drug treatment and other services instead of sending them to jail. LEAD has been a success. And it stands in direct, direct budgetary conflict with Durkin's proposals.
And Durkin in the past has tried to defund LEAD.
Yeah.
That's not gone over well with council.
Which in my mind really marks Durkin out as a conservative Republican. LEAD has been a real success, but it is way understaffed and underfunded compared to the number of cases that they need to process. They're, you know, having three city council members sit down and propose the exact same proposal to fully fund LEAD while at the same time putting direct hold on any budgetary money going into these new programs by Durkin really tells you what the city council thinks of Durkin's agenda. Now, in the meantime, Sally Bagshaw has proposed allocating just $3.5 million to LEED because she thinks that LEED can raise the other $1.2 million from private donors. And that shows you, that kind of shows you where she's coming from, too, as an ally with the Downtown Business Association, Mayor Durkin, and the more conservative elements within the city. Now, in addition, Lorena Gonzalez is proposing that the city revive the sex workers diversion program, which was discontinued at the end of last year. Mosqueda wants to allocate $280,000 to the Green Light Project for outreach to sex workers and drug users. And Mike O'Brien wants to spend $500,000 on a new treatment program for meth addiction. So those are some of the other proposals that fall under the treatments for high barrier individuals, homeless people, and folks who are struggling with drug addiction.
And almost all of those are better ideas than the way Durkin's
proposals. Than Durkin's proposals. Now, under the topic of homelessness services, Shama Sawant has proposed spending $12 million for 20 new tiny house villages, which has proved to be more successful. The tiny house villages have proved to be more successful at moving people off the street than enhanced shelters, the enhanced shelter system that Durkin is supporting.
And they're much more cost effective.
Yeah. Now, Teresa Mosqueda, on the other hand, would spend $900,000 to open only one new tiny house village that would hold 40 households. So she's got a 1/20th way proposal versus Sawant's proposal. Sawant hasn't talked about where all of the funding will come from, but, you know, there are those Mercer Mega Block proceeds sitting there, and there are other cuts that could be made to the budget. Abel Pacheco, the representative for District 4, has proposed spending $1.5 million to help Roots Young Adult Homeless Shelter relocate to a new building. Roots is currently based in the University District in a church where we're broadcasting from, which will be undergoing a major renovation and is pushing out its current tenants. Now, both Shama's...
And we should mention that Roots is the largest young adult shelter in the city.
Yeah.
And they're facing substantial problems with raising the money to relocate.
Yeah, and substantial costs, too, in on the order of $4 to $5 million just to relocate to a new space.
And one of the other youth shelters is getting shut down at the end of this year,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, PSKS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's needed now more than ever.
By kids from the streets, yeah. Now, both Shama Sawant and Lisa Herbold proposed spending $1.28 million on 5 mobile restrooms for the homeless. Herbold also proposed $818,000 to open 7 additional Parks Department restrooms and increase the frequency of cleanings during the fall and winter months. The city usually closes most of their parks restrooms for the winter. Bagshaw has proposed spending $244,000 to add shower services at 2 additional community centers and to repair existing shower facilities at other community centers. So there's some money in the budget for hygiene for the homeless as well.
Yeah, which is desperately needed.
And those 5 mobile...
These are proposed things that Durkin has not added into her budget that the city council wants to add for homelessness and hygiene services.
The 5 mobile restrooms was a program proposed by the folks over at Real Change.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which is inspiring. So that
A proposal coming directly from the homelessness community like that is something that the city council needs to consider and really take seriously.
Yeah,
something
particularly since the city's
Durkin's
approach
not
to,
doing.
No, the city's mm-hmm. approach to homelessness generally has not has shut out service providers and people who are actually on the streets dealing with the homelessness crisis mm-hmm. from inputting what's actually needed. They would prefer to come up with their own ideas, which have so far proven to be pretty counterproductive.
Yeah.
And again, the restroom issue has been a major issue here in Seattle for
as long as
decades.
I've been here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember in the 80s.
Yeah. And as it
80s
is
and 90s.
A nice note, David Goldstein, who Job knows, local writer, Just posted today, there's circulating online and social media is Mr. Bezos, the head of Amazon, just purchased another house, one in D.C. at the tune of about, I think, $25 million or maybe $28 million. Anyway, and it's got 25 restrooms, bathrooms in it. And David pointed out that's actually, that just turns out to be actually like significantly more than the entire downtown core makes available to the public. So
yeah,
again, a little.
Yeah, I don't, yeah. I think people don't fully understand how rich the super wealthy are and how much extra money they have to spend on stuff like that. You know,
I can remember, I think it was 1997 where ETH State led a protest downtown because the Downtown Seattle Association released a list of saying, we don't need a hygiene center downtown. Look at all these restrooms that are open to the public. And they listed Nordstrom's and all these other, you know, high-end retailers.
Westlake Mall.
And and so we had a procession of homeless people through Nordstrom's to use the restrooms there.
I remember that.
With rubber duckies and towels and all the rest of it.
That was very controversial. Yeah.
Yes, it was. It was a lot of fun, too.
Yeah. Now, also another issue in the budget were police services, and I'm putting the navigation team under there because I think it's really clear that the navigation team is not really part of the city's human services department. They're really part of the city's police response to what they perceive to be crime. As for the navigation team, Mayor Durkin wants the funding to make new temporary team members, which were added last year. She wants to make those permanent. They were added last year with one-time, one-year spending. Herbold has proposed continuing her budget proviso, which conditions the release of funds for the navigation team each quarter based on a quarterly report that the team and the mayor's office submits to the city council on progress on various measures that the navigation team is making, including whether they've undergone a racial equity toolkit and various other issues that are still outstanding with the navigation team.
And it's been interesting that conservative media in town, particularly some of the talk show hosts at Cairo, have really eviscerated Herbold over that and have been claiming that she's proposing abolishing the navigation teams when all she's doing
is asking
for accountability.
No. Yeah. No, she has not. Actually, it is Shama Sawant who has proposed cutting all funding for the navigation team. At the same time as Deborah Juarez submitted a different proposal, she wants the city to spend an additional $254,000 to add two members to the navigation team who would work solely in her district in North Seattle. Which would set a very, very bad precedent for the delivery of city services on a per-district basis. But the mayor has already opened that kettle of fish with her emphasis patrols, also part of the police department, those emphasis patrols in seven city neighborhoods this summer, which Mayor Durkin's budget now wants to make permanent. And we've already seen council member Abel Pacheco complained that the U District is not one of those neighborhoods, and he has a proposal to make the U District one of those neighborhoods in the city budget. And I don't think the city council really will benefit from playing that game of delivering services to whoever complains the loudest. And that's something that Herbold has criticized the emphasis patrols for.
And it has been interesting to see the change in culture on city council that has come in with the district system. And remember, Sawant is up for re-election. She's the only member of city council running for re-election who was originally elected citywide and is trying to get re-election in a district. Most of the districts now have their own political culture and are demanding accountability from their representatives, which was how the district system was envisioned as working. So it's been a real change in culture from, 5 years ago, when people who wanted accountability from city council had to figure out which committee it fell under and then approach that committee chair who very often just didn't care. So that has been good in general, but the precedent of delivering city services to a particular district, as Maria says, is not a good idea.
Yeah, in the case of the city budget, all of the city council members vote on it, so that is a check and balance there on the delivery of city services by district versus citywide. But when it comes to the mayor's office, the emphasis patrols were her idea, and she implemented them on her own without the city council approval. In fact, the city council had to request that the mayor and the Seattle Police Department make special presentations to them about what the emphasis patrols were and how they were designed. How did they get the information to decide which neighborhoods, et cetera? And it turned out that much of it was based on who complains the loudest, which businesses complain the loudest to the city. So that's what I would say is a very bad precedent. Now, also, speaking of which...
And note that's businesses, not residents.
Yeah, speaking of which, Sawant has proposed cutting $3.33 million from the Seattle Police Department budget to end the mayor's emphasis patrols, which Durkin, as I said, wants to make permanent, to cut hiring bonuses, which don't appear to be working. The Seattle Police Department is still struggling to hire enough people, and the bonuses don't seem to be making a difference. And the mayor's new recruitment and retention program, which Sawant doubts will be any better. She's the only one who is proposing major cuts to Seattle Police Department funding. Lorena Gonzalez has also proposed that the Seattle Police Department develop a system of reporting that accurately captures data on race and ethnicity, because currently they are not doing that. They have some general data, but it is not accurate and is not comprehensive.
And that was a major issue in the reform process, where the reason the Department of Justice in its investigation of SPD didn't find abuse of use of force based on racial information, because the police department simply didn't track it.
They are tracking it now, but the tracking is not comprehensive. It's not accurate. And Gonzalez would like the Seattle Police Department to, get on the stick, do what you promised in the police reform process, and actually start using tools that will accurately track this information. And then under transportation in the budget, Mike O'Brien has proposed reallocating $2.5 million of the Mercer Mega Block proceeds for building out the bicycle master plan. Abel Pacheco has proposed spending $1.4 million to add 3,000 parking spaces for bike share and electric scooter shares.
And building out the bicycle master plan, in the case of O'Brien, means extending the Burke-Gilman Trail to West Ballard.
That's part of it.
Which is a major issue that has run into a lot of opposition from waterfront businesses in Ballard.
And it's divided the two candidates somewhat in District 6 for the upcoming city council races, with Heidi Wills advocating a disastrously expensive idea of elevating the missing link on the Burke-Gilman Trail, whereas Dan Strauss is looking at more practical solutions for that, although solutions that may not be as popular with bicyclists as just continuing along the railroad track,
or popular with those waterfront businesses,
which are
complaining that the bicyclists would make it harder to get in and out of their parking lots.
Well, and the businesses that tend to be industrial based businesses. Mm-hmm.
Two important groups that are pitted against each other. Now, other transportation issues. Herbold has proposed placing a hold on all funding for the City Connector streetcar until the city comes up with a funding plan, which they don't have. In case the federal government doesn't award the $75 million grant the city has applied for, which is highly likely, given that Donald Trump and the Federal Transit Administration are simply not giving the same kind of grants that they did under the Obama administration.
No, they're simply not funding public transportation.
Yeah. Now, Herbold also wants to put a hold on money for Metro's Rapid Ride H line until the Seattle Department of Transportation coughs up the final design for the H line, which it initially promised in the fall of 2019. And guess what? The fall is here, but Metro hasn't delivered any information on that to the City Council yet. Or SDOT has not delivered any information to the City Council yet. And SDOT has had a history of not providing enough information on their projects to the City Council.
And for people who aren't familiar with it, where would the H line go?
I don't know that yet. I think it's Del Ridge. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the issue. It's like, where is it going to go? We don't know, because SDOT hasn't provided any information. Now, Sally Bagshaw has also proposed $2 million for a fancy redesign of four blocks of Thomas Street from Fifth Avenue North to Dexter Avenue North. That's a stretch that runs from the Seattle Center to South Lake Union, and it borders on the Gates Foundation. Now, of course, that $2 million is not really needed. It's just another part of the Mercer beautification project, as far as I can tell. Meanwhile, Shama Sawant has proposed that the Seattle Department of Transportation do a study on what it would take to make all transit services free in the city of Seattle, with the study to be completed by June of next year. That's her proposal. She hasn't proposed any money for that yet. She just wants SDOT to look at it. What would it take? Now, there are a few, anything on those, Joff? Okay, and there are a few miscellaneous proposals, too, that I want to just point up. Sawant proposed the Office of Economic Development spend $50,000 to survey small businesses in the Central District that are under stress from development and displacement. There is Sawant doing something for the businesses in her district, unlike what her opponent says. She does do some things, and she is in particular protective of small businesses and businesses that are run by immigrants and former refugees.
And businesses that are being dislocated by development.
And people of color, yeah. And Lisa Herbold also has proposed that the OED, the Office of Economic Development, spend $150,000 to connect small local manufacturers and producers with technical and financial resources. So there's Lisa Herbold doing something for the business community, particularly small local manufacturers and other small local producers. Now, Teresa Mosqueda proposed a $1 million increase in funding for the Office of Labor Standards outreach programs to educate low-wage workers and their bosses about new Seattle labor standards, something that is very important given that the City Council continues to pass legislation that governs labor standards in the city of Seattle, keeping business owners, and particularly business owners that employ low-wage workers, up to date on what their requirements are is very, very important. As is enforcement. So that's a really good proposal as well.
All right.
Okay.
Anything else on that?
Nope. That wraps
move
up
on
my budget
to,
review.
Yeah. I'd like to mention for people who find this kind of information valuable, that we are a volunteer station. All volunteer. Listener supported.
We're a 501c3 as well. So remember us in your year-end giving.
Yes. And, for people
and
who
your
want
wills.
To make... Yes, we don't have a specific bequest program, but we can help you with that.
Yeah.
For people who want to make a donation, there is a Patreon button and a PayPal button on the website at kodxseattle.org. Or if you want to mail a check, make it out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and send it to
P.O. Box 45883.
That's
Seattle.
That's 45883.
You are correct.
98145 is the zip code.
This is Mike's turn to shine for the hour.
Yeah.
don't step on his line.
Just repeating
so,
it.
Thanks to everybody that's supported us.
Absolutely. We couldn't be doing this without you.
Yes.
Literally.
So moving on to national and developments related to Washington, D.C. and impeachment.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, we had some major developments in the impeachment saga this week. The House, on a pretty much a party line vote, approved rules governing the public testimony and the actual impeachment hearings process that will start in the middle of November. So that will be coming up in a couple of weeks. Coming up next week will be the release of some of the transcripts of some of the closed door depositions that the House Intelligence Committee has been taking from various important witnesses, and what is leaked out from those testimonies, particularly the opening statements of some of the witnesses and some of the statements by committee members, has been not very exculpatory for Donald Trump. In particular, this week we had a couple of major witnesses, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman and Timothy Morrison from the National Security Council, who was the number two to John Bolton, collaborating the quid pro quo demands of Donald Trump.
And, yeah, they're the first people from the National Security Council who are weighing in on this.
Yes, and Vindman actually was listening on the infamous July 25th
phone call.
Well, so
was Morrison.
I think
they both were.
So this is important collaboration that testimony will likely be made public in the near future. Look for it probably next week. It's been interesting because Republicans in Congress really haven't been able to contest the impeachment process based on the facts, based on the actual case against Donald Trump, because it's pretty conclusive at this point. So they've been reduced to complaining about the process, which has been a little disingenuous for a couple of reasons. Number one, that there are near equal number of Republicans on that committee who've had a chance to ask questions of witnesses, et cetera, during those depositions. And number two, because this was the exact same process that was used by Republicans in the impeachment of Bill Clinton a couple of decades ago. So with the announcement that there will be open hearings and some of those
With the House vote, they've pretty much closed the door on that argument.
Yes, and with several of these key witnesses likely to be testifying in public, again, mm-hmm. coming back and testifying before Congress in public under oath in the coming weeks for the public to see, that, again, sort of short-circuits the complaints about the process. So this leaves Donald Trump to complain about the human scum that are testifying against him. Which is not going over well with anybody, really, because some of these witnesses have been serving the public, whether it's in the military or in the diplomatic corps or some combination of that, for decades. Their patriotism is really pretty much unimpeachable, no pun intended. So this is a process that is not going to go well for Donald Trump, at least until he gets to the Senate, because as we saw with the impeachment vote in the House this week, Republicans are pretty much sticking by Donald Trump, regardless of what they think about the actual problems in public.
With one exception, there was only one Republican who voted yes to.
There were none.
No, there was one. Justin Amash.
He is no longer a Republican.
He is technically an independent, but he started out as a Republican in Congress.
That is
true. He left the Republican Party deliberately over its defense of Donald Trump's misbehavior during these proceedings. So it'll be interesting to see if any other Republicans get a conscience and do something similar.
And it really is they're between a rock and a hard place, because regardless of what they think of these assaults on the Constitution in private, in public, they're defending him because they're afraid of being primaried by supporters of Donald Trump. So they're putting their own careers ahead of the oath they took to defend the Constitution, which is really pretty indefensible in its own right.
Which is what Donald Trump is doing, right? I mean, much of what he's doing is he's trying to put his own career ahead of the good of the nation and recommendations from his own advisors.
Yeah.
And breaking the law
do it. And his ability to garner more wealth, as though he needs it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Now, what the mechanics of this vote means is, as Job said, the hearings will now become public. They'll start out in the Intelligence Committee, which is where the closed-door hearings have been happening. That's the committee chaired by Adam Schiff. He could hold more public hearings in the House Intelligence Committee. Eventually, he'll compile a report, and then he'll send that report to the House Judiciary Committee. Then the House Judiciary Committee will review the report, decide whether or not to call more witnesses, and eventually recommend or possibly dismiss. But I'm not I doubt that will happen. They will recommend articles of impeachment to the full House. Now, in the Judiciary Committee hearings,
and they're hoping to do all that by Christmas.
Yeah. In the second stage, in the Judiciary Committee hearings, Trump's lawyers will be able to cross-examine witnesses, object to questions, and suggest witnesses of their own, but only with the approval of the chair of the committee, and that's Democrat Jared Nadler of New York. Nadler can shut down Trump's lawyers if he determines that they're not cooperating with the investigation by, for example, telling witnesses not to testify or refusing to honor subpoenas, which is something that the Trump White House has already been doing for months now.
And we should mention that Nadler has a long history of butting heads with Trump. He represents Manhattan.
Yes.
And he has...
Their history goes back
a
ways.
Yeah, Trump Tower is in his district, and they have a long, long history going back decades of not particularly caring for each other.
Yeah. Now, while he can shut down Trump's lawyers in the Judiciary Committee, he can't block Republicans who sit on the Judiciary Committee from asking questions of witnesses in the public testimony portion. So Trump will have his defense regardless. Now, the House, as Job says, is going to be in recess for a week, and then the public hearings could begin as soon as November 11th. And we'll see once the testimony becomes public if Republicans in Congress are still going to be willing to defend Trump's actual
Yes.
Actions.
And although the House will be in recess this week, the Intelligence Committee is going to continue to take depositions behind closed doors, and they have several important witnesses, including potentially John Bolton coming up this week. So we're going to continue to see headlines
about Bolton agrees to testify.
Yes, and he has said that he is willing to testify, but only if he's subpoenaed, basically.
Yeah.
So we'll see whether he shows up. We'll see whether other administration figures show up as though some of them already have, defying the White House's pleas not to and demands not to. So we're going to continue to see headlines from witnesses before the Intelligence Committee behind closed doors this coming week, but it will become all public very soon.
Mm-hmm. All right. Other related developments?
I wanted to mention the Washington Post had a story last night that this may not have been the first time that the Trump administration and Donald Trump personally have extorted the Ukraine. People with long memories of the various scandals of the Trump administration may remember that in the initial Mueller investigation of Paul Manafort, the former campaign chair, who is now sitting in federal prison for laundering Russian money and failing to report it to the IRS, among other violations, he was also being investigated by Ukraine itself for the money that he took from a previous administration that was pro-Putin there, and an infamous black ledger that was found from the party of that deposed president had off-the-books payments to a number of foreign figures, including Manafort. That investigation was shut down by the Ukrainian government in May of 2017, just after Mueller began his investigation, and it wasn't very clear at the time why. Well, we had a report last night in the Washington Post, and now we potentially know why. In June of 2017, Rudy Giuliani met with the new president who had succeeded the former president there, President Poroshenko. Manafort was being investigated as part of a $2 billion black ledger investigation. That investigation was quashed by the Ukrainian government. And they also dropped in cooperation with a new Mueller investigation. In exchange, the U.S. Decided to facilitate delivery of Javelin missiles that it had promised as part of the military aid Congress had appropriated. This may sound familiar. Those missiles were then delivered a week later. And Poroshenko also got a White House meeting that he wanted with Donald Trump. So White House meeting, check. Military aid held up and then delivered, check. In exchange for something that Trump wanted for his personal political fortunes, check. So this may have happened before, which would make it not surprising that Donald Trump tried to go to the well again this summer and this spring with efforts to pressure the new Ukrainian administration of President Zelensky, who so far has not been willing to cooperate, unlike the previous president.
All right.
Which should make Donald Trump very happy that the new president is trying to stamp out corruption, but apparently not.
Okay, and plenty of campaign news this week as well.
While all this is unfolding, the Democratic efforts to win the nomination have been proceeding apace. We're now only 2 months away from the first Iowa caucus, so it's starting to heat up. There was a new poll this week showing that not only is Joe Biden no longer the front runner, that would be Elizabeth Warren, but Biden has dropped to fourth in the state of Iowa behind Warren, Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg, who has been surging thanks to an infusion of campaign money that he's been receiving.
Yeah. And Buttigieg, I think, is being viewed as the sort of conservative Democrat who could replace Joe Biden.
Yeah, and Biden really has been struggling to deliver a coherent message for why he should be elected, other than that he was next to President Obama. He is still polling very strong in some early primary states like South Carolina, which have large African-American voter contingents. But his support among African Americans, unlike Buttigieg, is still very strong. But we're seeing Warren now being the front runner. She also this week released a plan that she'd been under a lot of pressure to release, showing how she would fund her Medicare for All proposal. That comes to a tune of $20.7 million. A lot of it would be funded based on taxes on the wealthy,
Trillion. sorry.
Yeah, you're right.
I think we keep up with it.
It is trillion.
It's over 10-year time frame.
Yeah, and that's a little bit less expensive than Bernie Sanders' plan, but still comes with a heavy price tag.
I can give you the details on how she would pay for it.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Yeah. Now, there are seven pieces to that. First off is the employer contribution equal to what average employers currently pay for health insurance premiums. Instead of paying them to insurance companies, they would pay that to the federal government.
Yeah, so there's no net change in what the private mm-hmm. insurers would be paying. They'd just be paying it to the federal government.
Instead of to insurance companies that have to make a profit. Now, secondly is what employees usually pay to cover their share of health insurance premiums. If your company does cost sharing, would come back to you as higher pay, then you'd pay more on taxes to the federal government on your increased income, which means more government tax revenue that would be plowed into the Medicare for All system. And third piece is that a Wall Street transaction tax of 0.1% on the purchase of stocks, bonds, and other securities, including derivatives. And then the fourth piece is a tax on large corporations to get rid of bonus and accelerated depreciation, which lets corporations write off their equipment purchases and thereby reduce their income and tax in the year that they buy that equipment. Then she would also include a tax. She would also tax the foreign earnings of U.S. companies to crack down on U.S. companies that park their cash in offshore bank accounts instead of bringing it home. The fifth piece is she would raise the wealth tax from 2% to 6% on all wealth above $1 billion. She would also do a small tax on unrealized gains on securities and investments that people hold. That's called a mark-to-market tax, if you understand tax law. That would be for the wealthiest 1% of households. Everybody else would not have to pay that. She would also crack down on tax fraud, especially by the rich she would do that by putting more money into the IRS audit division to audit wealthy taxpayers who are not audited nearly as much as middle income taxpayers. And she would, the sixth piece is immigration reform that would bring undocumented workers out of the shadows and into the mainstream economy and thereby get them paying more in federal income taxes as well, which would add money to the federal budget. And then a final piece would be cutting defense spending by $798 billion over 10 years. And I think folks might remember that cutting defense spending after the Berlin Wall was supposed to lead to a peace dividend, if you remember that. That could still happen, and it really should happen. And
yeah, the military has gotten huge raises in their budget over the last several years.
Particularly in the war on terror.
Yeah, so that would actually roll back some of those increases, but not all of them. And it's important to note that Warren had been raising a lot of pressure, and this has come up in the last couple of debates, are you going to raise taxes on the middle class? And the answer to that with this plan would be no. Mm-hmm. She's largely avoiding that with her plan and focusing the revenue on the richest 1%.
She's also been criticized for valuing the plan at $20.7 billion when there are many folks saying, no, it's going to be closer to $30 billion. Well, that's if you look at the way healthcare is funded right now and the way costs have gotten out of control right now. Her plan also includes many, many ways to cut costs in healthcare while still delivering the same level of services, and that's an important piece of it, too.
Yeah, so like Sanders, it's a serious plan and worth looking at. We should also mention that Joe Biden is coming to town. He's desperately needing to raise money, so he's going to do a presentation before Amazon executives and try and get some of their money. For the third quarter, those federal spending totals are in now, and Biden finished fourth among the Democratic contenders behind Bernie Sanders, who raised $25.2 million in the quarter. Warren was 24.6. Buttigieg came in third at 19.1, and then Biden was way behind at 14 million. So he needs to raise money as well. He has very little cash on hand compared to those other candidates.
It's nice to see Warren and Sanders on top there as well.
And it's again interesting that that Biden is not doing well in terms of fundraising, even though his appeal is largely among older voters who have more money to usually spend on campaign contributions. but he doesn't have a lot of grassroots support, unlike Sanders, unlike Warren.
Events.
Yeah. Coming up this week, we have Sunday from 4 to 5:30. There will be a celebration of the life of the late Elijah Cummings. That will be at First AME Church at 1522 14th Avenue in Seattle. Also on Sunday, New York Times' Julie Hirschfield Davis and Michael D. Shear have a new book out called Border Wars, Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration. They'll be talking about their findings. That'll be $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.
At 7:30.
At 7:30, yes. Tuesday, of course, is the deadline for getting your ballots in the mail. And, of course, there are drop boxes around the county also where you can deposit those ballots. But get them in by Tuesday because this is an enormously important election. And as we mentioned before, we'll be deconstructing the results of that election next week. So stay tuned for that. And then on Wednesday, November 6th at 7:30 p.m., the Vulnerability Pipeline, a great panel with links between foster care, homelessness, and child sex trafficking. That will be at Town Hall, again, $5, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.
All right. Yeah, I think we're going to be deconstructing the upcoming election for the rest of our lives.
We'll certainly be talking about the impact of it for at least that long.
Yeah.
Maybe later.
All right. So you're both back next week? Is that the plan?
Yes.
That is the plan.
All right.